Are there certain dogs that learn better than others?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it equivalent to people that have ADHD or something?
Yeah, okay. So there's a variety of factors that govern that.
What would you say is the biggest misconception that people have about dog training in general?
We treat dogs like they're little people. So people assume understanding from a dog when their dog has no idea what they're talking about.
On social media, they have these dogs that they say can talk by pressing on a button.
Okay, cool.
Is that a real thing?
I don't think so.
Oh my goodness.
I think that what the dogs have learned is...
A lot of people have said that the electric collar is fantastic. It's what works. Or is that wrong? Is there a certain kind you should do?
I'm one of those people that does not advocate for using that tool right off the bat. There's an entire foundation of teaching that goes ahead of that.
I recall when they're teaching you how to explain to your dog where to pee. And if they pee on the floor, you're supposed to like put their face in it and tell them no. Even if that was 20 minutes before, do they have that kind of memory for that? Is that bad training?
No, that's bad training.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Today, we're diving into the fascinating world of elite dog training with none other than Michael Ellis, a world-renowned expert in canine behavior, obedience, and working dog training. Michael is the founder of the Michael Ellis School for Dog Trainers, where he has revolutionized how trainers, handlers, and dog lovers build relationships with their animals. With decades of experience in protection sports, obedience competitions, and police canine training, Michael has developed a unique approach that blends motivation, engagement, and communication to create highly skilled and well-balanced dogs. He has also been a key figure in shaping modern training techniques through his work with Learburg, making expert-level training accessible to all. In this episode, we'll unpack what makes a great dog trainer, the biggest misconceptions about training, and why relationships between humans and dogs is more complex than you might think. Michael and I break down the meaning behind common dog behaviors, how to better understand your pet, and why the relationship between humans and dogs is more complex than you might think. Whether you're a dog owner looking to strengthen your bond with your pet, or just fascinated by the world of elite canine training, this is one conversation you won't want to miss. Let's get into it, my conversation with Michael Ellis. Michael, it is such an honor to have you on our show today. Thank you for joining us on Misunderstood.
Oh, Rachel, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really wanted to have someone like you on and someone with all your expertise and your years of knowledge behind you, because people that are dog lovers love their dog and would love nothing more than to be able to speak to their dog. And a lot of times it doesn't happen the way we want to, no matter how much money we put into the training. So you are the best person to answer the questions about what is misunderstood about what we are doing with our dog training. So before we get into that, I wanted to ask you how you got into this. What was your childhood experience like with animals that made you love doing this and make this into your life's mission?
Sure. I have a kind of interesting arc here, and I started like many people in dogs as a kid. I wanted a dog really badly. Finally convinced the parents at 12 years old to let me get a dog. They let me get a German Shepherd, but with the caveat that I would have to train it. So I took a class from the local German Shepherd Dog Club in San Diego, and it launched an interest in dogs. So I got into showing dogs in confirmation, competitive obedience through the AKC and that sort of thing. And then when I was in high school, I went to a dog show and saw a demo of police and military dogs at a dog show. And I immediately, as a 17-year-old, was like, hey, I want to do that. Of course, none of the dogs that I had were at all suitable for that kind of work. So I joined a local dog club and learned to do what they call the decoy work, or the person that gets bit by the dogs, because I was young and relatively able. Mm-hmm. And I kind of entered into the sport world that way. I had no intention of making it a career at all. It was a hobby all through high school and college. And right about when I was graduating my undergraduate, a club that I had trained with in the past as a sport trainer had a bunch of new members, and they asked me to come back and give a little kind of introductory clinic to the new members. And so I did that. It went relatively well. And another club asked me, hey, will you come and give a little clinic to our club? And I said, sure, why not? And I did another one and another one and another one. And it slowly kind of picked up steam. And while my wife was in graduate school, I decided that, well, I'll do some dog training while she's in school. That way we shouldn't both be in school at the same time. And I started to do more and more seminars, and we were living in New York at the time, and I did some pet dog training on the side while I was there. But most of my career has been teaching to dog trainers or dog training organizations, either dog clubs, police, military, service dog organizations, all those sorts of things. And I guess one day I sort of looked up after doing lots and lots of these and said, I guess this is my career. And so for 10 years, 12 years or so, I traveled full time giving clinics to dog organizations. And in 2009, I was a little bit tired of traveling every weekend. I was traveling 40 weeks a year. I decided to open a school for dog trainers. I could have sort of settled down and done private dog training, but I'd been coaching dog trainers for the last more than a decade. So in 2009, I opened the Michael L. School for Dog Trainers, where trainers came either to learn from the ground up to be dog trainers, or already experienced dog trainers would come to kind of keep up with what was current, sort of as a continuing education sort of thing.
Do they get a certain certification from you if they do your program?
They did. So now I've been doing that for, well, I guess 16 years now. And this last year, I sort of moved away from the full-time in-person dog training school.
Okay.
I've moved into an online format with a membership service, and I give a half a dozen clinics a year to kind of special organizations and groups. So in an attempt to sort of slow down and not do the 70-hour work weeks anymore. So
I'm curious why dog trainers as opposed to training pet owners, like you said. Is there a difference between who's listening, maybe? What, why?
Yeah. So I think part of it was because I had come up as a dog trainer, as a sport dog trainer, and as well as a pet dog trainer, and was coaching other trainers, I felt that I had sort of more to offer other trainers that were interested in getting into dog training. I also felt like I could impact more people if I hit trainers. So if I'm going to go out one-on-one and help individuals train their dog, then there's only so many people that I can contact. Year.
So is it
if I train other trainers, then it's sort of a trickle down effect, right? And they get out there and those trainers affect, and it's kind of a multiplier effect. So I decided I could sort of do the most good there.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you know, now that you are so into the dog training world and the dog trainers, what would you say is the biggest misconception that people have about dog training in general?
That there is some specific single thing that you're going to do that's going to solve your problems or make your relationship with your dog, right? Dog training, when it's done correctly, is sort of boring and undramatic, right? So people have a tendency these days, I'm sure you're well aware with the the world of social media, that people have a tendency to look at things like, hey, there's like some quick fix to this, or it should be really flashy if it's good. But really, dog training is just about consistency, relationship, showing up, and it's very incremental. And it's an ongoing process, right? So one of the things that you see is that people think, oh, I can do 2 weeks of work or 6 weeks of work or 2 months of work with my dog, and then my dog will be trained. But it doesn't work that way. It's kind of an ongoing process, and it's really incremental. And so I think for most people, that's the biggest thing. When you take the average person and they are having an issue with their dog or they want to work with it, they go to a trainer and they say, how long is this going to take? All right. Like, are you going to be able to fix my problem in X amount of time?
Right. And
so I think that's the biggest misconception, is how long it takes and what it kind of looks like on a day-to-day basis.
Right. So I know a lot of trainers focus on obedience, where I think from what I've learned, a lot of what you do is really relationship building. Am I correct? Mm-hmm.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, both things, it all comes together, right? So I think there's a little bit of a misconception about obedience as well. Like, people look at obedience just like, oh, I'm going to tell you what to do and you're going to do it because I said I do it, right? As opposed to, this is a collaboration that comes out of our entire relationship. And if the dog and I play together and I find ways to motivate you and I'm consistent and I provide good leadership, then the obedience portion of it sort of takes care of itself. But it's a holistic process. Everything you do with the dog is training, whether you want it to or not. And that's one of the things that people struggle a little bit with as well, this idea that when I'm not training right now. You're always training. Everything you're doing with the dog affects your relationship and how that's going to move forward. So getting people to kind of look at the big picture is an important piece of the puzzle as well.
Right, right. Would you say, in talking about obedience, you know, so many people struggle with whether it's okay to use those shock collars or chains or, you know, keep them in the crate most of the day and unless they're out training. What are your thoughts on that?
I think every tool that you see around in dog training at this point is there for a reason. And there are specific situations in which all of those tools are useful and the right solution for a given dog. And so I think the biggest problem now is people want to say, there's one way to do this. And that tool's a bad tool and that tool's a good tool. They all have the potential to be good and bad, depending on how they're used. And what is the right solution for one dog is completely the wrong for another. And so right now, my mission is to sort of educate people on the proper use of all these tools and the situations in which they might be used. Not meaning that you would use one on every single dog you encounter, but they have their place. And so, and when they're used correctly, they work beautifully. There's no damage to the relationship and the dog. And you'll see many, many very happy working dogs that enjoy their lives. And they, those tools also have the potential, if they're used correctly, to give the dogs more freedom, right? Mm. So one of the things that happens when people have dogs that are disobedient is they don't take them places, right? If that dog is unruly and they doesn't come when it's called and things like that, that dog leads an impoverished life because it doesn't get to go out to all the places that the well-trained dog does. And so if those tools allow us to access a larger life for a dog, then I think it's a worthwhile trade-off.
Well, that's a really good point, actually. Let's talk about that. So like, for example, I have a dog, Nala. I have three. Nala is a great dog, but I live in Florida. I've never brought her to the beach because I'm very scared. Her recall is just terrible when she's distracted. I've tried everything. I've taken her, you know, she's gone away to different programs. When she's with other people and the trainers, she is so obedient. We trained her in Manhattan. He would walk down the street in Manhattan with no leash on her, and she would just totally be obedient, follow him, not be distracted. Well, forget about it. In my own backyard, I can't even get her to come inside because she's chasing rabbits and doing all these things. I'm dying to get her to go to the beach. And as you said, there are so many people that have pets that they would love to bring places. What would be a great tool or some, you know, options of how to do that kind of thing?
So I think I'll hit that in a second, but you touched on something that I think is incredibly important. In the dog training world these days, what we call a board and train or an inboard training programs are incredibly popular. So somebody that is busy with their life sends a dog off to get trained by a professional. The professional may do exceptionally good work. The dog may be wonderful with the person that trained them, but that doesn't mean that the dog's going to listen to you. And the transfer of information from the person that maybe taught the professional trainer to the owner is the most critical part. And dogs are not machines. It's not like once you've finished it, the dog's going to do that for anybody. It's about you understanding the process and all the things that went into it along the way and then participating along the way. And I think some of that is a flaw in the design of the way a lot of trainers design their board and train programs. And if you're not heavily involved in the process and practicing along the way, then the dog's not going to listen to you, right? They don't understand that. It's completely different. So for me, the tool that is most commonly used to finish good recall work in pet dogs is an electronic collar.
Right.
And they can be controversial, right? But if they're used appropriately, the modern collars can be very subtle. And if they're used properly over what we call a reward-based foundation, meaning the dog has been taught properly to recall for rewards and people have gone through all the incremental steps, they introduce that tool properly, then that can be a great tool for kind of finishing it off and making sure that the recall is reliable in real-world situations. And that's what everybody wants. I'm not saying that your dog would necessarily need that. You'd have to sort of see what's happening in your relationship, but that might be one of the tools that people would use to finish that work, right?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I had our mutual friend Cameron Ford on, and he talked about that relationship between the canine and the handler being so important, because if you don't have that relationship, the handler won't know to be listening to the dog properly, and the dog won't, you know, be able to do their job properly. So
right.
I do agree. And, you know, us sort of laymen in this dog world or, you know, a dog owner, for me, the dog sleeps in my bed. I cuddle it. You know, I saved the dog in Manhattan in a situation where she was found tied to a post with staples in her head. I don't like to yell at her. So,
right, sure, of course.
So I let her do whatever she wants to, you know, to much to the dismay of my entire household. I'm a terrible trainer. Although for me, you know, and like a lot of people, we're obsessed with watching the social media about trainers like Caesar and all these people that you walk in and they change your life in an hour and you go home. I know it's not really how that works.
No, that's right. Television.
But a lot of people have said that the electric collar is, you know, fantastic. It's what works. I think it's hard to, again, for the average person to know which one to buy, how strong you make it. But I think it's maybe a little trial and error, or is that wrong? Is there a certain kind you should do?
I think the idea is anybody that's contemplating using the tool should get professional help, right?
Right.
Because there's a lot of nuance to how it's used, right? So how it's introduced, what the dog's previous training was, and the levels at which the collar is going to be used are wildly variable depending on the individual dog.
Right.
One dog is very sensitive and using on a tiny, very low level. And if you've played around with any of the modern electronic collars, they can be incredibly subtle. At the lower levels, you can barely feel them. It's a little tiny tingle, right? And so they have a lot of possible range of use. And so getting it adjusted to a given dog is something that takes a little bit of experience. And if you're not becoming a dog trainer, if you just want your dog to be trained properly, then I always encourage people that are going to use that tool to get professional help. That way somebody can walk them through the step-by-step parts and they can help you figure out what levels the dog's going to work on and maybe what foundation pieces you missed, because that's the biggest part of it. When we talk about using something like an electronic collar, I'm one of those people that does not advocate for using that tool right off the bat. There's an entire foundation of teaching that goes ahead of that so that the dog has a good relationship with you, understands what the behavior you want them to use to do, like what the recall command is. They've been rewarded with something they like repeatedly for that. So there's a whole process of generalizing and teaching that goes ahead of the use of that. And that's sort of like the final piece that comes in and helps finish the thing off.
Okay. Well, can you talk a little bit about that for someone who's trying to teach their dog basic recall or not to jump? What are some beginning steps that are really important that we might be missing that seems maybe obvious, but really isn't?
Sure. So without getting too technical, like there are a whole series of steps, but you start out with, if I were going to take a brand new dog that doesn't know what come when called means, and I was going to teach that, right? I'd start out doing something that we call restrained recalls, which means somebody holds your dog and you have a reward for the dog, whether it's a food or a toy. You get the dog excited and you move away from the dog. And when the dog acts like it wants to come to you, you call the dog and they let the dog go and the dog runs over to you and you give it a reward, right? So now the dog's learning what that word means. And then there are a series of steps in which we teach the dog to focus, that to come when they're focused on something they want. So I take an assistant and the assistant takes food and kind of gets the dog to follow them away from me. Mm-hmm. And then when I call them, they take the food away and I make an attraction and the dog runs back to me and I reward the dog for coming to me. So now that dog's learning, even when you're focused on something you want, if you hear come or here, you turn and you leave that and you come back to me. And there's a whole series of those steps. And then there's a step where I introduce a leash to them and I help tap them towards me with the leash. And then the final stages of that would be potentially to bring in an electronic collar and on low level use that to remind the dog, hey, this way, right? When the leashes and stuff come off the dog. And so if that's done properly, then the dog knows exactly what come or here means. Mm-hmm. They've had lots of rewards for doing it. And now they're excited to do it. And if they get a little distracted by something or there's something out there that they want more than they want the reward. Mm-hmm. So you're going to hear this a lot of discussions in the dog training world now about what we call purely positive or force-free methods versus more traditional methods where people would use aversives or pressure to get a, make a dog do something they didn't want to do, right? And those two worlds shouldn't be separate worlds. We all teach our dogs with rewards. We all want the dogs. We use positive reinforcement throughout the teaching phase. The issue comes for most average dogs is when they want something else in the world more than they want the reward, right? So reward-based or force-free training breaks down. If my dog likes chasing squirrels better than it likes food, the dog may know I have food. It may know come means to come, but it's like, ah, thanks, but the squirrel's more interesting to me. I'm taking that, right? And that's the place that that something like the electronic collar might come in and bridge that gap for us.
Got it. So, and I'm curious, are there certain dogs that learn better than others?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. There's
is
no
it
doubt.
Like, is it equivalent to people that have ADHD or something or what?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So there's a variety of factors that govern that. So one could be that one dog is very distracted and has a hard time concentrating. Some dogs are just quicker learners than others, just like humans. Like there were subjects in school that I was good at and I picked up on quickly. And there were other subjects in school that I wasn't so good at and I had to work harder to connect those. And then the other big ticket item here is motivation, right? How motivated is the dog for rewards, the traditional rewards that we use in dog training? Food, toys, physical affection, those kinds of things that we're using to reinforce behavior or reward behavior. The more motivated the dog is for those, typically the easier they are to train. The right. less motivated they are for those things and the more difficult they are to train, right? Which is obviously, right? So if the dog doesn't want something from me, it's very difficult for me to go like, hey, come on, this is fun, right? And a big part of our early training with the dog is to try to make them enjoy training, right? This whole process of interacting with me is fun. So the more motivated they are for the rewards, the better that tends to go.
Right. What could you tell us about what animals or what these dogs think? I mean, it's so hard to get into their minds and you read all these articles about, you know, if they do a certain behavior, it must mean this. I mean, you've been working with dogs for so long. What would you say is misunderstood about what they think and what should we know?
I think one of the biggest things is that we treat dogs like they're little people, right? Mm. So people assume understanding from a dog when they don't understand necessarily what you're talking about. Like the average person speaks to their dog in full sentences. They're inconsistent about how they follow through on things. And so imagine you were in a country where everyone was speaking a completely different language, right? And you were trying to figure out what these words meant. Mm. And people were talking at you and they weren't saying something like saying a specific word and pointing at a table for you to understand. They were speaking in full sentences and you had to pick out which word in that sentence meant table, right? And right. then they weren't consistent about saying table and pointing at the table. Sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't, right? Yeah. And this is what the average person does with their dog. So the dog looks at you trying to figure out and pretty soon goes, I can't make hide or hair what you're talking about. Because right. there's this idea that dogs understand what's coming out of our mouth. We have to work kind of hard at that. Like dogs aren't verbal creatures, for instance, right? They don't talk to each other. And we talk around them all the time. Mm. And 99.9% of what comes out of my mouth has nothing to do with them. Mm. So they learn if unless what comes out of my mouth predicts something very consistently for them, they start to tune that out. They just move it to the ignore file.
Right.
And I think that's one of the biggest things that people are assuming understanding in their dog when their dog has no idea what they're talking about.
Right. So, but do you think they really understand what you mean when they've learned the sit command or the stay command? Do you think it registers in their head that they're supposed to sit or it's like the Pavlov thing where they just know to move their body down and they're going to get a treat? I mean, do they understand like that?
A well-trained dog understands, but they go through a whole series of levels of understanding along the path when you're teaching them. Right. So if you ask most people if their dog knows how to sit, they say, oh, sure, my dog knows what sit is. But their dog frequently knows sit in a very specific context. Maybe they know sit in my living room or my backyard when I have food in my hands and the dog's in front of me. Right. That's one picture. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean the dog knows how to sit when they're next to me or at a distance from me or if my back's turned to them. Or when I don't have food in my hands, all those things are part of the picture. And what we call this process of learning to understand something like a command or a concept in a variety of different situations, it's called generalization, right? And dogs look at an entire picture. They're like situational learners, right? And so there's a really fascinating woman. You may be familiar with her. Her name's Temple Grandin. Mm-hmm. And Temple is autistic, and she's written books on livestock science and autism. And yeah, she realized cool. when she was in college that as someone that was on the spectrum, she saw the world sort of the way animals did. And she has a great book called Animals in Translation, right? Which is a really interesting book. And what she says is that someone's that's on a certain level on the spectrum, they see entire pictures. They think in pictures. And that's kind of what dogs do, right? So if my dog learned sit while it was in front of me and my hands were in front of my body and it was looking at me and I made this sound sit, they know it in that context, but it doesn't mean they know it in other contexts. Most of the work of dog training is transferring that to a bunch of different contexts until finally the dog says, aha, I get it. That sound means put my butt on the ground regardless of all these other things that are happening, right?
Right.
And that takes time. That's when I talked earlier about there aren't kind of quick fixes and shortcuts to this. Your dog may understand a cue in a specific situation, but that doesn't mean they understand it everywhere.
Right, right. How much do dogs pick up on human emotion?
Oh, immensely.
More so than a word.
Oh, absolutely, right?
Okay.
In order for them to attend to a word from me, I have to work really hard. But they're very attentive to our emotional moods, right? They watch us, they observe us, they are social creatures, and no other creature in the world works as hard as dogs do to figure us out. It's kind of heartwarming. If you could work with any other kind of animal, they can be smart, they can learn, et cetera, but dogs are unique in their ability to want to sort of fit into our social structure and to figure us out, even when we're being inconsistent. So they're very sensitive to our emotional states. If you raise your voice, or if you're in a good mood, a bad mood, frustrated, the dogs feel those energetics really quickly. And that will strongly influence your relationship and the training process as well. Yeah.
Huh. Can they be trained to help with their owner's emotional state?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So a lot of the emotional support service dogs, dogs for veterans and people with PTSD, all in that service dog community, a lot of those dogs are highly tuned in to signs of oncoming emotional signs of seizures or nervous breakdowns or anxiety attacks. And the dogs can be a step ahead of that. If a well-trained dog can be a step ahead of that, and they can actually warn somebody ahead of time, or even learn to do certain soothing behaviors that help kind of a person work through an anxiety attack, for instance, right?
Yeah, I've seen that, examples of that. You've got to explain that to me. How are these dogs trained to do that? And when sometimes we can't even see those cues.
Yeah, so it's a specific kind of dog. So what they do is they take a lot of different dogs and they teach them to pay attention to their handler, right? So the first step is just reinforcing them for paying close attention to their handler. Mm-hmm. And those dogs are strongly bonded and they learn to look at their owners and pay close attention. And then we hope... And then they teach them some kind of behavior that they're going to do when prompted. Let's say they're going to teach the dog to come up and paw you. And so they teach that behavior separately and they put a cue to that behavior. And now the dog watches you. And when you're getting anxious or whatever, a trainer would then cue the dog to paw at you. And you hope that through repetition, this could be true of kind of seizure activity, all kinds of stuff. And then the dog learns, if the dog's attentive, a certain type of dog will pick up on the precursor signals. If they watch you often enough and they're with you often enough, they'll pick up on that. And then they start to offer that behavior when they see you entering that emotional state. And they may notice it before you do, right? In those circumstances. Not every dog can do it. So
is it a certain breed, or it's just a certain attentive
specific
dog?
Individual dog? Yeah. And so if you talk to service dog trainers and organizations that are trying to breed and train dogs for this, they have about a 70% washout rate. So meaning like only about 30% of the dogs that enter their programs are actually capable of doing that stuff. Right. And the dogs, and that part of that is just one dog just doesn't notice. One dog doesn't pay close enough attention and another dog doesn't care the same way. So it's a kind of a specific suite of treats that make that happen. Traits.
Could you take a dog out of a shelter that has had a completely different life before and train it to understand a new human like that?
Sure. Yeah. And again, it's wildly dependent on the dog's past history. Mm. Like, what has that dog had in its life that's going to make it easier or harder to train it to do this? But a lot of service dog organizations, go take dogs out of rescue and put them through programs, their success rates are lower than they are with what we call purpose-bred dogs.
Yeah.
A lot of the larger service dog organizations, for instance, an organization like Canine Companions for Independence, one of the biggest service dog organizations in the country, they're breeding like golden retrievers in labs and gold retriever lab mixes because those dogs tend to be nice dogs to train and do well in a variety of situations, specifically for that job. So they get a slightly higher success rate than you would if you were taking dogs out of rescue. Because some of those dogs have early experiences that make it very hard for them to do their those jobs. Not impossible, but hard.
Right. Do dogs have feelings and memories like we do?
They absolutely have feelings and memory, for sure. They have excellent memories, right? We assume that their feelings are something akin to our feelings, whether or not they're the exact same kinds of emotional states that we have, or the same kind of feelings we do, it's impossible for us to tell. In recent years, with our ability to kind of do brain scans on dogs and things like that, we know that they can look at a dog's brain and say, hey, guess what? The same part of a dog's brain lights up as it does in a human when they see someone that they love. Or if a dog is anxious, a certain part of their brain will be active, and same as us. So we can assume that they are fearful and happy and frustrated, but these are, we do have to make a leap, a scientific leap, because we can't really see inside and we can't ask them, but they certainly have emotions that are in some ways approximate what we have. There's no doubt.
There is a world of opportunity out there beyond the typical 9-to-5 where purpose and grit and the American spirit come together in the Peace Corps. It's been called the toughest job you'll ever love. Tough because it asks so much of you. And the love part is knowing your hard work can transform lives and build bridges across cultures. After 65 years, the Peace Corps is still the toughest job you'll ever love. Explore opportunities in more than 60 countries and apply at peacecorps.gov/serve. That's peacecorps.gov/serve.
Holistic Goddess has been such a trusted resource for me on my health journey. One product I really wanted to highlight is their Holistic Menopause Support by PhD Health. It's been a game changer for me during perimenopause, and here's why I love it. It eases discomfort. It really helps with hot flashes and mood swings. The ingredients in it, including creatine, support mental sharpness. I feel more focused and clear-headed, which is so important for my busy days. Go to holisticgoddess.com and use code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off all orders. So, I mean, this is a total sidebar, but now that we were talking about, you know, dogs in shelters or something for a second, you know, are these dogs sitting in there panicking because they're like, where is my owner? I'm lost. I'm so miserable. And you hear about these rescues that are like, please come take, you know, foster these specific dogs because they're having a much worse time because this is not the environment they're used to. Is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, heck yeah. There are dogs that do not handle that environment well at all, right? Because nothing in their early life prepared them for it. Right. And there are other dogs that remarkably do pretty well in that environment.
Yeah. Right?
And it's a stressful environment. You can imagine dogs, if you've not ever been in a kennel or you haven't been around a lot of other barking dogs or any of those kinds of things, could all be extremely stressful for a given dog.
Yeah.
Some dogs handle it great. Others don't. Right.
Right. What could you tell us about behaviors and signs? Is there a universal sign for being happy? What does licking mean? You know, all things like that.
Sure. So when you look at physical signs of dog's emotional state, then generally speaking, you want to look at all the traits in combination. If we focus on any one specifically, it can give you some misinformation. So for instance, people will take tail wagging, right? And there's a type of tail wagging that a dog does when it's happy, right? When it's happy to see one. And that tail wagging looks a certain way, meaning most of those dogs have a tendency to carry their tail kind of low, and it does big, wide swinging sweeps, and their whole body tends to wiggle back and forth, right? Mm-hmm. There's another type of tail wagging that dogs will do when they're excited or aroused, meaning they might do that when they're about to chase something. And it tends to be, the tail tends to be a little higher and the wagging tends to be a little stiffer. It's not big and sweepy and loose, right? And so if somebody says, hey, my dog's tail was wagging, that meant he was happy. Well, not exactly, right? yes, for one dog, that's telling you they're happy. For another dog, it's just telling you they're stimulated or aroused, and that dog may be ready to chase or bite, actually.
Right.
Licking, for instance, dogs will lick their lips sometimes when they're stressed. A dog that will lick at a person kind of obsessively, those dogs that come up and lick, 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 lick. Mm-hmm. Some of that can be what we call active submission or appeasement behavior. Like if you've ever watched a kind of sensitive dog approach a more assertive dog, the more assertive dog will stand up really straight over the top of them and be sort of stiff. The other dog comes in low and comes up under their face and licks at their mouth, like lick, right. lick, lick, lick. That's a submissive behavior that says, hey, don't hurt me. I'm not a threat to you kind of thing. Right. So licking can be anything from, ooh, you taste good. You've got something interesting on your hands to some sort of submissive appeasement behavior to I'm stressed. Some dogs will close their mouth and they'll lick their lips a little bit when they're feeling stressed and that kind of thing. So what you want to try, what we do when we're educating people about dog body language is we talk about all the different aspects of body language and you look for groups of behaviors together, right? So is the dog, like for instance, a classic example that a dog is potentially going to do something you don't want them to do is they get really stiff and still. If dogs get still and they stare a lot and they're stiff, that may be a precursor to barking or if two dogs are meeting each other, you'll watch two dogs meet and one of them will stand really stiff. And there's a moment where they're kind of trying to decide, is this other dog okay or not okay? And if they finally decide they're okay, suddenly they loosen up and they're bouncing around and their whole body language gets happy. Other dogs are stiff, stiff, stiff. And then next, you know, they're fighting with the other dog. So it's difficult to pick a single trait and say, this always means this. And that's one of the other common misconceptions, that people are looking for some simplified way of saying, oh, I just have to watch and see if my dog's tail wagging, or I have to watch to see if their tail's up or down. All those things together with other traits or tell us kind of what that dog's mood is. And then there's also individual dog differences. Like, so for instance, huskies are very upright, ears up, tail up in the air all the time, and they stare at stuff all the time. Right. But that's just the way they are. Huskies are like that. If my husky's acting like that, you're like, oh, that's kind of normal behavior for a husky, right? If my German Shepherd is like that, then I'm like, okay, be careful. If your German Shepherd's upright and staring and stiff and staring at something, they may be thinking about barking at that thing or aggressing. There's all kinds of things. So I encourage owners, dog trainers, et cetera, to kind of learn the suite of different traits and different body language traits, and then learn the individual dogs as well. You get to know a dog as you observe them and say, okay, I know with this dog that behavior is okay. With this dog, that's not such a good thing. And learning to read the individual dog is important. It's a little like people, right? You learn to, there are some general things about human body language that we can make generalizations. And then within that, you have to adjust it as you get to know somebody. Like, oh yeah, that person has just their faces looks like that. They're not pissed at you. That's just how they carry themselves. Like you get to know it. That's all there is.
Right. Why is it that dogs, almost take on their owner's persona when you're walking them on a leash? Meaning you always see these people that, you know, say their dog is so great, but when they're on a leash and they walk past somebody, they start to attack the other dog or their people. And they're like, but they're not really like that. And I think it might be because they're protecting me. What is really going on in that situation? Coming from New York City, that happens often.
All the time. Yes, it sure does. So there can be a lot of things that are happening there. And one of the things can be the handler. So we call this, is you're describing one of the most common behavioral issues that dog trainers deal with. And we call it leash reactivity, meaning you have a dog that may be fine off leash, but when somebody kicks him out around the neighborhood for a walk, the dog's blowing up at other dogs or strange people or all those kinds of things, right? And there are a variety of things that can contribute to that. Sometimes it starts out of insecurity, right? When a dog's on a leash, if the dog is nervous and another dog's approaching, and if they were off leash, they might have moved away. They might have said, here comes another dog, I'm going to go someplace. But they're on a leash, so they can't move away. So they feel like they're fight or flight. They're like, I can't go anywhere. That dog's coming at me. Ah, and they blow up. And if they bark at the other dog and the other person goes, oh gosh, and crosses the street, or the handler then pulls the dog away, the dog says, oh, that's how you resolve that problem. Anytime you're nervous, just blow up and that thing will go away, or the handler will take me away, right? So it could be nervousness. It could be frustration. Sometimes the dogs are on a line and they see another dog and they want to play, and the handler's holding them back from playing. And the more they hold them back, the more frustrated they get. And that frustration turns into anger, right? And so once a dog has learned to erupt, then a lot of times the handler is uncomfortable, right? So if my dog, if you've gone out on a walk with your dog and your dog's blown up at six different dogs, now every time you take your dog out for a walk, you're nervous. So you're walking along and you see another dog coming, and all of a sudden you go, oh gosh, here comes another dog. You tense up, you pull on the leash, your dog goes, looks at you and says, ah, you're nervous too? I was nervous. Oh, okay, I got this. And they go off. So the handler can be contributing to it. It's rarely the dog protecting them. Mm. I can tell you that. There are dogs that are protective of their handlers, but more often than not, it's one of the other factors that are creating leash reactivity.
Right. We were talking about smell earlier, and I've read that there are dogs that can detect illnesses and cancer in people. Is that a real thing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Heck yeah.
How are they trained for that? Is it the same what you were talking about, like the service
Absolutely. And Cameron could speak to this really well, because you had him on. That's his business's detection. And that's basically what they do. They teach the dog to detect certain odors. And with medical alert dogs, they just expose them. They do everything from teach them what the cancer cells themselves smell like. They get samples of those and they teach the dog to look for those. Sometimes it's the changes in the person's body chemistry that are related to that. Like diabetic alert dogs do that. Like that handler begins to potentially behave differently, but also smell differently as their blood sugar goes up or down. And so it's all the same sort of thing. And you would teach some kind of indication behavior. You would teach the dog to use its nose and pay attention to that. Yeah, right now there's all kinds of different areas where they're teaching dogs to use their nose. Conservation detection for kind of invasive species, the medical alert dogs, cancer detection dogs. They've been looking to teach them to detect diseases in bee colonies for honeybees. There's all kinds of stuff that they're teaching them to scent. Their sense of smell is exceptional, right? And once you identify what they need to identify, then you can pretty much teach a dog to detect anything that they can actually smell.
So from everything you're saying, it seems like dogs are much smarter than a lot of people give them credit for.
Yes, I think they're smarter than people give them credit for, and then they're also less smart than people give them credit for. So I think a lot of times, I mentioned this before, with companion and pet dog owners, they are assuming their dog knows things that they don't know, right? And so a lot of, for the average pet dog, somebody says, my dog knows this, like he knows he shouldn't do that. He knows that that's bad behavior. You know, all those things that you hear people say, I can tell because he acts guilty when I catch him doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of assumptions that the average person makes that the dog knows something that it doesn't actually know.
Do they actually feel that emotion, guilt?
I do not think they feel guilt. What they do is they've recognized the situations in which you're unhappy.
Right? So that upsets them.
Yeah. So let's say your dog got in the trash when you weren't home. And you came home and the trash was all over the floor, and you came up and you went like, oh my God. And you yelled and got all mad, and the dog's like, oh gosh, crazy. So the next time you're gone, did your dog learn that getting in the trash was bad? No. While the dog was getting in the trash, it was great. What your dog learns is when you arrive on the scene, if there's trash on the floor, then you're going to be upset. So they get stressed. And so their body language says, oh no, dad's home and there's trash on the floor. Oh, I recognize this situation. So they look guilty, but really they're just reading your emotional state in that moment, right? And at the time they were getting in the trash, it was lovely, right? So that's a kind of common example there.
Right. And we were talking about memory, and you said they had a good memory. You know, I recall when they're teaching you how to explain to your dog where to pee, and if they pee on the floor, you're supposed to like put their face in it and tell them no, even if that was 20 minutes before. Do they have that kind of memory for that? Is that bad training?
No, that's bad training, right?
Okay, so tell me what you're supposed to do.
Any feedback should, if you're not there when the accident happens and you return and they've had an accident, or you come in and they peed in there 20 minutes before, chalk that one up to you missed it. Clean it up.
Because they won't get it. Unless they're in the middle of that action, they won't understand.
They won't get it. You got to catch them when they're doing it.
So it's like a Helen Keller thing. You really have to be explaining it to them over and over in the moment until they have that, like, absolutely. Ah, I got it. Yeah.
And it may not take a lot of times if the timing is good, meaning they're right about to go to the bathroom. Like you see them, okay, my dog's about to squat in my living room. And I go, let's go outside. No, let's go. And if I've done my work up to that point, like taking them outside repeatedly to a given place and teaching them that's where the bathroom is, then the first time they go to make a mistake, if I catch them in the moment, it doesn't take very many times. And they go, oh, I get it. It's okay to go to the bathroom out here. Just don't do it here. But if you miss that, even by a minute, like if you were a minute later, they're not going to associate that. And dragging them over and rubbing their nose, none of that stuff is going to help, right? It doesn't teach them. It's too late, right? Timeliness is really important because we can't explain it to them. With a human, I just explain to you with words. With a dog, I can't do that. So the timeliness of the outcomes, the rewards or the punishments is super important. It has to happen just at the right time. And they go, okay, I know what that's for. And I get it.
Right. You've had so much experience in training dogs. So my biggest question for you is, what has been the most impressive thing that you have seen a dog be able to learn to do?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think some of the scent work stuff is incredibly impressive in that the low concentrations of certain odors that dogs can be taught to find, and the fact that the dogs can find these in really difficult environments sometimes. Another thing that I find fascinating is some of the border collies and things like that, that they've used. The border collies are highly trainable dogs. And so people tend to use them as sort of the poster child for like the genius dog kind of thing.
Right.
They have very good memories. They pick up on things well, and they're very motivated. So there's, for instance, this older gentleman in Germany, I think, that's taught his border collie the names of something like 80 or 100 different objects. And he can send his dog out of the room, and each of the different stuffed toys has a different name and all these different things. So the dog's has been able to memorize 100 different objects.
And that's a real thing.
That's a real thing. Yeah. So that's super impressive. That dog's ability to, like most dogs say, like, hey, go get your toy would be kind of easy. You teach the dog to go get, my stuffed guinea pig or whatever the heck it is.
But go get the Barbie might be harder.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the dog had to do it based on verbal cues alone. And I said before, like dogs, it's hard to get dogs to pay attention to words. So the number of different words that dog knew is quite impressive, that kind of thing.
Right. That is impressive. Oh, I have a question. You know, you've seen, or maybe you haven't seen, but on social media, they have these dogs that they say can talk by pressing on a button. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Is that a real thing?
I don't think so. I think that what the dogs have learned is like a certain button to activate a certain outcome, but they're not going to go put sentences together with it. Like they're not going to understand syntax and things like that. But a dog could learn to, for instance, hit a specific button when it wants to go outside, right?
Right.
And like, hey, I could hit this button, you'll take me to the door. They could learn something like that. But that for them to be able to speak with them, I don't think so.
I had a couple of people write in some questions that they were interested to have your opinion on. What's your opinion on the rise of emotional support animals? Are they being overused or, you know, misunderstood, mistreated in this whole being able to fly with peacocks or whatever people are trying to fly with?
Yeah. That's being abused like crazy. So there is absolutely a place for emotional support dogs for people that really need it, that have severe anxiety or PTSD. There's a lot of places in which that's a useful thing. There are lots of people that just want to take their animals with them places. And so they get a doctor to write them a kind of fake note, or they go through the process, and there people are taking animals on planes and in airports that they're not prepared for. And it's likely going to get it banned for people that need them, right?
Right.
Enough bad stuff happens and enough animals that are going in there that are not under control. I can speak to the dogs especially, right? If the average person does that and their dog isn't trained, that dog's going to act up in public or on the plane, and then it's going to wind up causing trouble for the people that really need them. So
On a sidebar, what are your thoughts about the way the airlines treat animals when they go underneath the plane?
My experience for the most part has been they're very careful, right?
They are.
Yeah. Yeah. So their liability.
No, it's only few and far between where you hear these horror stories.
Yeah. Like the amount of animals that are traveling all over the world at any given time, and the amount of incidents are quite low. And I think most of the airline personnel are really strictly following very strict protocols to make sure that the animals are safe and things like that. But
so the temperature is being regulated and it's pressurized.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They tend to be extremely careful about that, right?
Yeah.
There's always somebody going to do something they shouldn't. Somebody's going to take a shortcut here or there, but it's very infrequent, very infrequent.
Right, right. With social media, it seems like everyone is a dog trainer. So are there any viral training trends that drive you crazy that you've seen online that are just complete no-nos?
Almost all of them, right? The viral train, the issue with them is they're oversimplifying everything to get attention. They're playing into the fact that somebody wants a quick fix to their dog problem, right? And everything that's both on social media in general and on TV is geared towards that, right? I have a good friend that is a reality TV producer, and number of years ago, he was like, I want to do a dog show with you. And I'm like, Brian, you don't want to do a dog show with me. You're not going to want to put on the show that I want to put on. He's like, no, really, really. And I'm like, okay, this is what I would do. And he's like, yeah, no, I'm not doing that.
Right? Why? What would you want to do?
So I would explain how it actually works and go through. It would be like the old Bob Ross painting show for dog training. It would be
slow, I love
that.
That's
methodical,
genius.
And actually the way dog training works. But there's such a pressure to make something look like, oh, look at this terrible problem these people can't have. Here comes the professional trainer with the magic solution. They come in and in one day or 30 minutes, they've solved the problem, right? That isn't like there will be situations in which that looks good for a minute. But if you asked those people 6 months later, if the dog was fixed, that's not how dog training works, unfortunately. Right. So I think most of the stuff on social media is meant to kind of catch someone's attention and oversimplify this. And there is great information out there, but most of it is all edited and chopped to show only the good stuff. That's another thing. People aren't up there showing their mistakes in most cases. Yeah. And that's what people need to see. This is what it looks like along the way. It doesn't just go from here to here. There's all these little steps and oops, we went wrong there. We had to work on that a little bit because I made a mistake there. And nobody wants to show that stuff. And so you get a real kind of unrealistic idea of what dog training actually is if you watch too much of that stuff.
Right. I'm curious. We had somebody on the show before who runs a foundation where they take dogs who are on the euthanasia list in California and they pair them with prisoners. Mm-hmm. And they go through a training program where they train these dogs that have behavioral problems and they train the inmates to train the dogs, and they're in there for 3 months. Can that actually be a successful program in your opinion?
It can. It absolutely can. So it has benefit to both dogs that are in rescue and the prisoners in that it gives them a sense of accomplishment. And then maybe the ones that are good at it when they get out, they have something that they can direct their energy into potentially. So it has the possibility of being really useful. The issue is, of course, if you're picking dogs with behavioral issues and you have people that don't have a lot of experience with dog training, right? Then I'm sure a significant portion of those things don't work out the way we would like them to work out. But if you got the right dog and the right inmate, then I think absolutely that's it's a wonderful thing, right? And so, and the effort that the attempts to do it, I think is fantastic. I think that's a great thing, right?
I do love that program. What about your opinion on bad dogs? Is there such a thing as a bad dog, or is it a bad person that's taught these traits to a dog?
Yes, I think there's such a thing as a bad dog. So meaning there are dogs that inherently have like very high levels of genetic aggression and things like that, that some of that stuff is just the dog, right? I think more often than not, it's improper rearing and improper early exposure and not proper direction from their owners and handlers. That's much more common than the bad dog thing is. But certainly, there are dogs that are just aberrations, right?
Like with proper training, can those bad dogs, the majority that we're talking about that are just have learned bad behaviors, can those be retrained later in life?
Oh yeah, lots of them can. And when we say retrain too, like dogs that have behavioral issues, outside of puppyhood and adolescence. Mm-hmm. I have a 4-year-old dog that has this behavioral problem. The chances that you make that go completely away, that you erase it, right, is slim to none. Mm-hmm. But the chances that you make it much better and the person learns the situations in which they can put the dog and those in which they can't put the dog, that's what you do. You make, for a lot of the dogs with established behavior problems, you make them better, you teach the people how to handle it, and you say, your dog will be good here, 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 and here, avoid here. Mm. You're just, your dog's not, that's a bridge too far for this given dog, right? The earlier we catch it in a dog's life, the easier it is to change it. It's just like habits with human beings, right? There's reasons there's entire branches of psychology devoted to helping people break habits. Bad habits, right? It's not so easy. Ask anybody that's trying to quit smoking or other bad habits. You're not procrastinate anymore. Those things are not easy to change if you have a long pattern of them. And dogs are no different in that way. So we are more successful the earlier we catch it. And with an older dog, it doesn't mean we won't make progress, but we may never completely erase the behavioral issue.
Do you believe that certain breeds have some bad traits in them? Like a lot of people will say pit bulls are terrible dogs, extra large bullies, I think have been banned in the UK. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you can make some generalizations about individual breed traits, but it can get you in trouble because it's just like generalizing about groups of people. Right. Yes, you'll be right some of the time. It's right. Pit bulls have certain specific traits or they've been bred to do certain things for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And if you don't handle them correctly, you can have a pit bull that will manifest behavioral problems. Also, there are tons and tons of pit bulls out there that are wonderful dogs. Right. And kind of just recognizing what dogs have been bred to do so that you in the early stages can prevent the bad things from getting started. Right. German Shepherds and the breeds that I breed, Belgian Malinois and Dobermans and Rottweilers, all these breeds were bred to be protective, right? It's part of their job description. Yeah. So if I get a German Shepherd that shows territorial aggression, is that a bad dog? No, it's a normal German Shepherd that has been allowed to do something that it shouldn't. And so the early training helps. So I think banning breeds is nonsense, right? One, it's going to be, you're going to, a bunch of good dogs are going to fall underneath that ban.
Oh, yeah.
The other piece of the puzzle is what breed generalizations allow us to do is kind of be a step ahead of things. If I know this breed has this trait, like if I have a pit bull and I'm raising a pit bull, I'm very careful how I let it interact with other dogs because they were bred for centuries for dog fighting. So if they start dog fighting, it's a lot harder to get them to stop. So what that does is that it's not inevitable that every pit bull is going to want to fight, but I better watch out so that it doesn't get started because it may be harder to stop once it gets started. And so that's kind of how I use breed traits as a rough guideline to kind of tell you what to watch out for.
Yeah. Do you still breed dogs?
I do, but pretty occasionally now. So I've been breeding Belgian Malinois for a little over 30 years. And so
as working dogs or
as working dogs? Yeah. I work my personal dogs as well. Right. So that like I have 5 Belgian Malinois in my house now, right? So,
how does that work? They're all just roaming around your house or what do they do?
Yeah, they are. They're just roaming around my house now. There's stages, various stages of their life where they're not. So when they're puppies and adolescents, they're controlled. But my older dogs all are trained so they can be in the house together and things like that.
And on a side note, do you believe that people should crate train their dogs? Or
100%.
Do your dogs sleep with you?
Sometimes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's one of those things that dog trainers will say, hey, don't let your dog sleep with you. Right. And what they're looking to do is they're looking to head off problems because they know the average person isn't going to pay attention to the fact that their dog is starting to get out of control. But having your dog sleep with you isn't necessarily a problem as long as you maintain structure. They only come up when you invite them and they get off when you tell them to get off, right? But the average person's doesn't pay attention to that. Now the dog's growling at them when they tell it to get off the bed and now they've got an issue. So
now they're sleeping on the floor and the dog's on the bed.
Not all the time, but some of the time they sleep with us and some of the time they don't. But all of that is kind of controlled. And crate training is wonderful. It helps with housebreaking. It's essential to manage a young dog so they're not getting in trouble all the time. If I need to travel, I want my dog to be comfortable in a crate. People that don't use them and they ever have to fly or travel somewhere with their dog or their dog has to go to the vet and stay in a crate or a kennel at the vet overnight, the dog's going to be super stressed if they weren't taught about those things in the beginning. So it's an incredibly useful tool. So all of our adolescent dogs and puppies, the crate's a big part of it. As the dogs get older, they get more freedom, right? Which is kind of normal.
Right. And I'm curious about the ones you breed for, you know, how they become working dogs. Do you breed them for a certain amount of months in a certain controlled environment and then you bring in a handler? Like, how does that work?
No, I breed them, and generally speaking, the puppies go out to other dog trainers that are interested in training for those things, right?
Got it.
So,
okay.
I don't raise dogs up to a certain, I mean, I have started a dog that I was
got it,
I was
but they'll just take yeah. they'll buy the dog from you.
They'll buy the dog as a puppy, generally speaking, right?
Right.
And they generally speaking go to other dog trainers.
Like right.
Belgian Malinois are become very popular, but they're a dog trainer's dog. Like
right.
Like if you do everything right, they're amazing. But if you do things wrong, they're horrible. And so the average person, unless you really want to take a deep dive into dog training, it's probably not the dog for you.
Right. And before I forget, because I know you do a lot of dock diving. Is that what it's called?
We have a dock diving pool at the school and the facility. Yeah.
Okay. I can't get my three dogs to even go in my pool. So how do you, and I'm watching these videos and your dogs are so eager to go running and then they fly. How do you get them to do that?
So there's two things. One is teaching the dogs to swim at the right stage so that they
don't like all dogs swim.
All dogs can swim, but not all of them like it, depending on how they were introduced to it. Right. So that's a part of it, is making sure they're introduced to the water properly in the early stages so that they don't hate it. Right. The second thing is for the dogs you're seeing, they're very motivated for toys.
Got it.
So we're selecting dogs that are crazy for their toy. So at a certain point, wherever the toy goes, the dog goes.
Like, got it.
They don't
care. They might not be crazy for the swimming
or
the diving. They just like the toy.
We bred a dog that held the world record in dock diving for many years. She's a little dog. She jumped 33 feet. Right. Oh, yeah. Right. And she hates the water, but she's absolutely bonkers for a toy. So you throw the toy, she's going. Then she swims back and she's like, oh God. But if you just said, hey, get in the water, she'd be like, no way. I'm not going in there for no reason. And you get other dogs that are bonkers for the water. Just love it right off the bat. A lot of lab puppies and stuff. You can't keep them out of the water.
Right. Right. I love watching those videos of the dogs that just jump in the water.
Oh, it's really fun. And the dogs that like it really like it. They have a blast.
They do. If someone could only implement one piece of training advice from you, what should it be?
Consistency. Consistency, 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 right? So I think that's the hardest thing for the average person, is that idea that they only think about dog training when they're training or when they're practicing.
Yeah.
But your routines, how you interact with the dog, what you allow and don't allow, be consistent. Like that, if you had to, consistency trumps more innovative training more often than not. Somebody can have better ideas and better skills, but if they're inconsistent, they won't get the same results as somebody that's a little less skilled, that's very consistent.
Right. Michael Ellis, I really appreciate your time today. Tell everybody where they can look up your classes if they're interested in learning more from you.
Absolutely. So you can go to our website, which is michaelellisschool.com. You can find us on Instagram at michael_ellis_school. And both those places will direct you to all of our programs right now. Right now, most of what I'm doing is going into a membership service that, so there are recorded versions of classes, my personal training journals in there, all kinds of resources there.
Yeah. I looked it up though. And there are some really great resources for the layperson that's not even trying to be a trainer. That is really good stuff that you can implement with your own dog at home. So I really hope people will go on the site, check that out, learn from you. And I feel like we got a lot of information today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.